I'm Roger Green, and welcome to episode 4 of Surfing the Nash Tsunami. I want to thank those of you who've been with us for the first 3 sessions. Particular shout out to the person who wrote in this week and said that he had binge listened to the first 3 episodes and found it relaxing and soothing. Needless to say, I never thought of my voice as being a particularly relaxing and soothing voice, so you gave me a good feeling. I appreciate that. And all of us, because we're delighted, since the person in question was a patient, that you can get that kind of reassurance from listening to us simply discuss what's going on with the disease. That's fantastic. As we get started, a couple of things are different and a lot of things are the same. We are without Yasmin today. She was unable to join us. Fortunately, we have an excellent guest sitting in with us, Louise Campbell. Louise is a patient advocate and a nurse activist based mostly in London, a couple of other places. She'll talk about that. And among her other honors, was selected as the Hepatology Nurse of the Year in 2018 by the British Journal of Nursing. As a patient advocate, Louise's perspective is likely to be different than Yaz's as an investor or an analyst, but equally valuable in its own right, and we're really excited to have her with us. Good afternoon, Louise.
Good afternoon, everybody. Nice to be invited, and thank you very much.
We're delighted to have you here. First of all, after episode 2, Niall asked whether and when we intend to cover the MASH-NAFLD versus NASH-NAFLD issue. That's now scheduled 2 weeks hence. I'm delighted to announce that Dr. Quentin Anstey of Newcastle University will be joining us to discuss the MASH-NAFLD perspective on the issue. If you're looking for a debate, I don't think you're going to get one. I think what we're going to get is more of a conversation about the needs that drove that position and how to deal with them in an appropriate global way. However, I think it's going to be a really exciting session. That's in 2 weeks. Next week, Louise will be back and we'll be talking about patient advocacy and supporting patients and how it's similar and different in the US versus the UK. This week, we had a question I do want to get to from Max in Canada. Max is, in fact, the binge listener in question who has a warm spot in my heart. And Max had 2 specific questions to Stephen. I'm going to read them both, Stephen. I think you take them both together. Number one, does NASH always wind up paving the way for cirrhosis? And number two, can NASH be reversed, ending in total recovery? Stephen, why don't you start, and then everybody else feel free to jump in.
Thanks for asking that question. Maybe another way to ask the question would be, how often does that occur? And that's where I think we don't have a ton of data, but we do have a growing body of prospective data that shows that NASH can progress to cirrhosis in about a quarter of those cases. Another of the questions that often comes to mind when we think about epidemiology and natural history of the disease in NASH is, who are those people that are likely to progress to cirrhosis that have NASH? And that's another area of intense investigation. One of the things we do know, one of the contributory demographic factors that we do know is associated with progression of disease is we know that if you have diabetes and you have NASH, that your rate of progression of disease might actually be more than a non-diabetic, but certainly you have a higher probability over time becoming a cirrhotic patient. The additional data that's come out is how quickly do people progress. And again, not a lot of data. The modeling that's been done has shown that average rate of progression is approximately 1 stage every 7 years. But again, based on the heterogeneity of this disease, that's also highly variable and also influenced by the presence of diabetes. And there are likely genetic and epigenetic factors that are also linked to this. Some of the genetic factors that we've recently found to be associated with fatty liver and as well as the severity of disease would be PNPLA3 single nucleotide polymorphism, and then the HSD17 beta 13 single nucleotide polymorphism, and then TM6SF2. There are others that are out there, but they haven't been shown repeatedly in multiple different GWAS studies to be predictive of progression or associated with more advanced disease. And I think the 3 big genetic single nucleotide polymorphisms are those that I mentioned. And then there's epigenetic factors. These are also contributory and more often environmentally linked, if you will. Maybe a simple way of looking at this is there's a nurture and a nature phenomenon to progression of disease. There's 100 million Americans with fatty liver. Why do only 25 million have NASH? Why are the other 75 million protected? You know, free fatty acids are very, very toxic to the liver, as well as the components of cholesterol, the metabolites of cholesterol, such as diacylglycerols, ceramides, and the like. So how is it that 75% of people with fatty liver are able to handle that free fatty acid load without developing a NASH phenotype? So that's also a question, and not just fibrosis progression to cirrhosis that occurs in about 25% of NASH. So maybe a long-winded answer to your first question. As far as the second question goes, disease regression can occur naturally. We learned from the Cenicriviroc trial, which was a trial that finished out a couple years ago, where liver biopsies were done at baseline at year one and year two. There were two different dosing arms and a placebo group, and actually 25% of the cohort was placebo across all three liver biopsies. We were able to get really kind of a mini natural history study, if you will. From that trial, we learned that about 20% of patients can regress their disease from year one to year two, and from year two to year three, those that actually got better could get worse, and those that got worse can get better, and really nothing was done to kind of temper that effect. There is a bit of a difference in fatty liver than there is, say, in hepatitis B or hepatitis C, where there seems to be a steady progression of disease over time. This one is more like a two steps forward, one step back phenomenon, and it may explain in part why the placebo group in a lot of our drug development trials in NASH seems to be higher than in other studies. But having said that, we do know, both from bariatric surgery data, significant weight loss studies, that you can literally reverse this disease. Now, what is often confusing to the population is, once you get scar tissue in your liver, can that be reversed? And I think the answer is unequivocally yes, up until a certain point. I personally believe that once you develop cirrhosis with complications of what we call portal hypertension, meaning develop hepatic encephalopathy, you develop fluid in your belly that we term ascites, you develop significant varices, these dilated veins in the esophagus and stomach, that the physiology becomes different, and it really becomes challenging to reverse that. But up until that point, I firmly believe that fibrosis is reversible. So I'll stop there and maybe open it up to my colleagues to see if they have anything they'd like to add.
Absolutely second to everything that you've said there. The only thing that I could add to that is that, having done an awful lot of patients for hepatitis C with decompensated cirrhosis as part of one of our advanced programs that the NHS put in very early, we have seen a number of patients from that background reverse and come out of portal hypertension as their liver softens up. And I just wondered whether or not you could suggest that there could be a similarity if you removed and treated with weight loss and programs at that stage. Would you expect to see an improvement in the liver condition in decompensated cirrhosis, for example?
I followed a couple of patients clinically for about 15 years that underwent either significant lifestyle modification, where they lost by themselves 100 plus pounds. Some of these people actually had cirrhosis with portal hypertensive complications. And while, yes, I've seen the ascites go away, I've seen the encephalopathy improve to some degree. I even re-biopsied one of these people, and they remained cirrhotic, and their platelet count remained very, very low. That's one of the things that I have noticed, particularly with NASH, is that I can't get the platelet counts back up. Once they go down, they tend to stay down. But I don't think we have really studied enough of these people, Louise, to really answer your question. I totally agree. I can take an autoimmune hepatitis cirrhotic, a hep C cirrhotic, a hep B cirrhotic. I can cure them or suppress them, and I see reversal of cirrhosis. We know that has been shown in those liver diseases. I just don't think we've got good enough therapies yet to know what kind of reversal of disease we can get. And is it only going to be clinical improvement, or will there be concomitant histopathologic regression of scar to the point where we say there is no longer evidence of nodular formation, we're back to bridging or something like that?
Thank you.
Okay, that's great. Let's jump into the opening round of introductions and just check-ins with everybody, and then we can go into today's main topic. Let me start with Louise. Louise, let me invite you to give a brief introduction to kind of who you are and what you've done in liver disease. And then the other question that goes along with that is, the most encouraging thing that you've seen in your professional life in the past week, although you may talk about one in your personal life.
I'm a nurse from the NHS of 35 years, and I left the NHS in September, having established a FibroScan delivery company, which was the first in the UK, called Towerson Health. And Towerson, for those who don't know, it means balance, equilibrium, and harmony in the Urdu and Arabic languages. And of course, the liver is all about balance and health. I've worked extensively in the NHS I was also fortunate to be asked to co-chair the inaugural Nursing and Associates Forum at EASL in 2012 with Nid Afdhel. I hold a master's degree in advanced practice and have worked in liver disease for over 30 years. The predominant reason I left the NHS was actually to allow patients or individuals, because we could all be a patient, greater access to diagnostics to give them the opportunity to find fatty liver disease and liver disease generally a lot earlier to potentially prevent developing type 2 diabetes, heart disease and those increased risks. And as we discussed and have discussed, people can reduce and reverse NAFLD in earlier stages and therefore reduce those risks of comorbidities that are driving non-communicable disease death. So that's why I'm here and advocating for patients and the greater access to medications, trials and diagnostics to find a disease a lot earlier than we do currently. I suppose my personal is that after a sort of 10 weeks of lockdown, I absolutely managed to do a social distancing meetup with my parents. And my mother, unfortunately, is one of the 1.7 million people in the UK that is isolated with my dad. So that was nice to see them looking so well and not touch anything or go anywhere near, but have sort of see them physically, which was great. And I suppose from my professional life, I suppose being asked to be part of your group, which has been extremely interesting and enlightening to listen to over the past 3 weeks. So thank you.
Thanks, Louise. That's great. Peter, why don't you go next?
Most encouraging thing in my professional life, which, as I've mentioned before, is for the past 2 years, I've been doing consulting for large pharma and small biotech in the area of liver disease and drug development. And what I have seen over the last week is an increasing need for the type of consulting advice that I provide. So there's no shortage of work. There's no shortage of companies to work with. And I think that that's very, very encouraging because, as many of you would know, consulting services are typically one of the first things to go away when economic times are hard and so forth. But this encourages me because it means there's a demand for planning for the future and people thinking about clinical trials, thinking about drug development. So I found that very encouraging and something that I'm kind of experiencing real time at this point.
Okay, that's great. Stephen.
Yeah, professionally for me this week, exciting times in Texas. We have opened back to screening. So we are, I wouldn't say full speed ahead with screening. We are dipping our toe back in the water. Hopefully this will be a sign of things to come throughout country as we kind of begin to get back to some level of normalcy, even though we have to all double mask and keep our distance and that sort of thing. We are still, I have clinic tomorrow. It's still going to be telehealth clinic, you know, 15 minutes per patient over the phone. It's hard to do new consultations, by the way, as a hepatologist over the phone, but it's something that we're trying to work through. But good news, we opened back to screening, and so hopefully that'll continue.
Excellent. So I'm laughing about your comment about telehealth as a hepatologist. I had an appointment scheduled for Thursday with my dermatologist because I've had skin cancer in the past. And I got a call from the office asking if I wanted to take the appointment as telehealth. I casually explained what the appointment was for and asked if they had a way to do this via telehealth. And the receptionist started laughing. That's right. There's some medicine you just can't do that way. That's fair.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do when you ask your patient, you know, feel your right upper quadrant. Do you have abdominal pain? Can you feel an extra edge there beyond the rib? And do you have ascites? I mean, at some point, they can tell you if their legs are swollen and you can look at them and see if they're jaundiced. That's the one good thing about being a doctor. You know, first thing that we're taught is to determine sick versus not sick. And often that's as simple as looking at the patient. Beyond that, the nuances of, you know, establishing a venous hum or a S3 on a heartbeat or something like that, we're going to be unable to do through telehealth. It's still limited.
But as you point out, getting in the right direction. My professional for the week is really simple, as listeners to this podcast will learn over the next couple few months. One of my soapbox issues in liver disease is about diagnostics. And what would we want to know and how would we want to do diagnostics in a more ideal world, or even if we were a different disease that had different kinds of histories and patterns. I've had a bunch of conversations about diagnostics with different people this week that suggest to me progress is being made. So I've found myself in more conversations with different classes of stakeholders about diagnostics and how to improve diagnostics in the past week than I want to say I had in the preceding month and a half. So I think that's a good thing because I think that's an area that will need work and conversation as time goes by. With that, as we noted last week, this is my week to set up the conversation. And certain panel members suggested that I might or might not be up to the pressure, so let's see what happens. I would like today's exercise to build on comments we've heard from all our panels previous to this week. Peter's concept that hope is not a strategy. Stephen's comment last week that the relationship between Nash and COVID-19 could wind up being anything from, I would describe it as coincidental, they're both happening at the same time, but they're not related, to causal, which is clearly liver health drives response to COVID-19. And then the general question that's arisen as to whether COVID-19 will lead government agencies, payers, and profession to think differently about the goals of treating patients with liver disease. Where that could lead us is the size of the market and the nature of the agents that are of value can vary dramatically depending upon one of three foreseeable big picture scenarios that might emerge over the next 5 to 10 years. I'm going to call those narrow NASH, broad NASH, and broad fatty liver. In narrow NASH, the emerging correlation between COVID-19 and NAFLD proves to be a correlation, but not causal. There's nothing about NAFLD that causes COVID to be more serious or more often mortal. In fact, it might be the other way around, or it might be a thing. And it turns out that treating the liver itself does not provide dramatic benefit in metabolic syndrome, compared to treating the other elements that we've been treating for a longer time, diabetes, cholesterol, hypertension, et cetera. At that point, the economic value of NASH drugs rests largely on their ability to prevent cirrhosis and liver cancer, with subsequent costs of transplant and a long, slow, expensive last 6 months or 12 months of life, with much hospitalization in many events. That would be narrow NASH. Broader NASH, COVID-19 and NAFLD correlation turns out to be non-causal, as I described, but NASH developers prove significant independent value in treating metabolic syndrome patients beyond what we're doing with the therapies that we already have for other manifestations. So, due to smart development of combination therapies and the research I just described, robust real-world evidence and health economics outcome studies combined with smart pricing decisions to create a NASH franchise that transitions from merely preventing cirrhosis to having an impact on total cardiovascular or metabolic health in anybody, even with early-stage NASH. That's broader NASH. Broad fatty liver is what I just described for broader NASH. Plus, it turns out that NAFLD is a predictor, maybe even a robust predictor, of how sick people who experience COVID will get and how many of them will die. That may also turn out to be true in other aggressive viruses. It's reasonable to believe that COVID-19 is not the only novel pandemic quality virus we'll see in the next 20 years. And as a result, treating NASH provides independent benefit in all these diseases, and a market develops to treat the NAFLD patients, particularly those who have other risk factors involved, so that they don't react so severely to viral infections at the same time that we're also focusing on metabolic health in early stage NASH and cirrhosis and liver cancer in late stage NASH. Those are the three scenarios, and I'd like to ask each of the panelists, speaking from the perspective of your stakeholders, so Peter, the C-suite, Stephen, the clinical research KOL community, Louise, patient advocacy, three questions. The first one's an easier one, I think. Take 100 points of likelihood and divide them between the three scenarios. So how many points would you put on narrow NASH being the outcome? How many points would you put on broader NASH being the outcome? And how many points would you put on broad fatty liver disease being the outcome?
I'll go ahead and start, Roger.
Thanks, Peter.
Thinking about putting from the constituency that I'm trying to represent on this podcast, which is really the company leadership, boards, stockholders, investors, kind of the C-suite of drug development, I want to point out that these tend to be conservative views. I would probably, in terms of that ranking, out of 100 points, I would probably say the first scenario is about 40 points. The second scenario is 50 points. And the final scenario where COVID-19 and liver health are intricately related and causal is only about 10% from thinking about the future. So the reason I rank things in that way from looking at it through the eyes of the constituency I'm representing is that This is a highly regulated area with regulatory agencies being very important. They tend to move deliberately is one way to describe it. And we only recently have, you know, acceptance of a one-stage reduction in fibrosis in pre-cirrhotic NASH with no change in NAFLD activity to be an endpoint that's approvable. And there's a lot of data that links the degree of fibrosis with morbidity or mortality in the disease. That has been a struggle to obtain that regulatory guidance. And I think each step of the paradigm that you've described, which is really a fascinating hypothetical structure, is going to take a lot of effort and clinical trials and so forth before you get to those regulatory requirements. And so I think that companies are going to be conservative in that regard. So for instance, we've got now one phase three trial with obeticholic acid that has met the primary endpoint for phase three. Clearly, there is a lot to be desired and a lot of room for improvement over the obeticholic acid results. We're now waiting for elafibranor results to see whether we can actually reverse NASH in a phase three clinical trial. That'll be a second important step. And each step of the way, whether it's reducing fatty liver and its association with cardiovascular disease or overall outcomes, is going to be a lot of effort. So I think that the first one we've got relatively well established. The second area we have we've got data coming out and it's looking interesting to kind of combine the cardiovascular risk factors together. The third point about a healthy liver in support of fighting serious viral infections is going to take some time to structure the studies that can weigh in on the regulatory infrastructure.
Okay, thanks, Peter. I guess Louise, actually, as I go left to right on my screen, you're next.
I think obviously I'm going to try and look at the patient's perspective from this. And I think it is one of those things that we're going to have to answer very quickly. In some respects, we're not as conservative. If I had to look at the three scenarios from a now perspective, which is probably very vital in COVID-19, it's startling how much liver involvement is in all of the comorbid conditions that cause severity. I think both the American Association for Liver and the European Association for Liver were very early in their timeline when they produced guidance detailing that people with NAFLD and NASH were at high risk of severe COVID-19. And I think that could be what we're seeing. But I'm also surprised that whilst we mention all comorbid conditions, we actually don't mention liver at all, except predominantly what is COVID-19 doing to the liver enzymes. If we look at patients with NAFLD, most of them are not diagnosed. You stated earlier, and Stephen did, that you've got 100 million people with suspected NAFLD in the US. We have 14 million suspected in the UK, but there's very little screening going on for diagnosis. And I think we have patients or people and individuals, mothers, fathers, cousins, brothers and sisters, who are at risk of NAFLD, who may have pre-diabetes and comorbid conditions that they haven't yet found. So if I was to look at these scenarios now and saying where we need to be feeling safe and where we can make a difference from a patient's perspective, we all want to know what we can do now. And I think I would probably err probably on 50 on the broad fatty liver opportunity. At the moment, there's quite a lot of synergy going on with some of these comorbid conditions, obesity and ethnicity involvement, I would go for 30 on broad Nash opportunity, and probably 10 on the narrow Nash opportunity, because whilst we don't have a vaccine, we do need to try and answer some of these questions quite quickly with retrospective data using ultrasound and diagnostics, because liver function tests are not going to be the best way in a septic condition of any description to help us look at that.
Thanks, Louise. That's a great answer. Stephen?
So just from my wheelhouse and where I see this, I put 20 points on narrow NASH, 70 on broader NASH, and 10, as Peter did, on broad fatty liver. What I've noticed with this pandemic is that everybody is aware that there's a pandemic. Unless you're living in some remote island, 187 countries have been impacted by this disease. And I can say that COVID-19 did in a matter of one quarter what NASH has never been able to do. And that is, disease awareness happened just like that with COVID-19. My question is rhetorical in a sense, but what would it take for something similar to happen in the NASH community, the fatty liver community? And I think we never would want NASH to go the way of COVID-19. We don't want to see the morbidity and the mortality linked to NASH that we've seen with this pandemic. But it brings about a point, and that point is there is a cross link. There is a Venn diagram, if you will, between COVID-19 and fatty liver. We've seen that in publication after publication, and more data is forthcoming, where we see that people that get into trouble with COVID-19 tend to be those that have the exact same comorbidities as a NASH patient. So we have the number one liver disease on the planet, which is fatty liver, and we have a pandemic. And I think, can we use this opportunity, or is there a way in which disease awareness maybe spawned through the pandemic, showing that there's a link with comorbidities to NASH and even elevated liver enzymes in the setting of NASH to drive disease awareness. I think where that happens, that will be key. But ultimately, I put most of my points in the middle category, broader NASH, because I do believe that the number one killer of a fatty liver patient is not liver disease, it's heart disease. Now, what's less clear is a NASH patient at higher risk of NASH than a NAFLD patient or somebody that has fat but not the components that would give them NASH? I think that's less clear. But I do think that it's been shown in multiple studies and that there is a link between CV outcomes and fatty liver. Now, here's the kicker. In 20 years, cardiologists have never been able to improve on primary prevention of a myocardial infarction. The rate of myocardial infarction, to my knowledge, as a dumb hepatologist, is exactly the same as it was 20 years ago. Now, where we've gotten better is secondary prevention by giving medications that lower LDL cholesterol and managing comorbidities, aspirin a day, things like that, we've impacted. But why haven't we changed the primary prevention in this disease? In my opinion, I think it's because so many people have fatty liver and so much systemic inflammatory response is generated from the inflamed liver that I suspect it's contributing to unstable plaque in the coronary arteries. And if we're able to mitigate that inflammatory response generated by the liver, that we will have impacts beyond the liver on comorbidities such as CV outcomes. And those trials, by the way, are just now beginning to get underway.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. So my answer that I would have given in the first place, you folks have just done a really good job of explaining why I'm about to give this answer. So I'll explain a little bit first. Please note on the issue of NAFLD and COVID, that if you come from a medical perspective or a clinical perspective, you tend to rate that very low right now. if you come from a patient perspective, as Luis did, you rated quite high. A lot of that, by the way, is linked to Stephen's question about what would it take for NASH to get the awareness that COVID did. Behavioral economics predicts that nothing is going to get more attention than something that has a really high risk factor associated with it that comes on you fast and you have no idea how to control, say a pandemic. Whereas a disease that creates toxicity over a longer period of time that folks have lived with is just not going to have the same drama. So I think the answer to the question, the third point about fatty liver and pandemic, will have much to do with the intensity of the second wave of this pandemic and whether we see another one for a year or two. If it turns out that the first pandemic of COVID is a one-off event in the world, things will never go back to exactly what they were. But focus on finding a more holistic understanding of serious viral disease, and particularly pandemic-level viral disease, will matter less. If there's a second wave in the fall or another pandemic in the next couple of years, that number will go way up. Me, I happen to think, based on everything I read, second wave in the fall will be reasonably significant. And as a result, I'd probably put the broad NAFLD number somewhere between 35 and 40. Because I think we'll find something there. If we get desperate enough to do anything, and as we approve the drugs we're approving right now, with limited trial, a certain level of desperation is indicated. This is a solution people will look for. I think the odds on narrow NASH being the end market are negligible, because I agree with Stephen. I believe that the studies that emerge over time will demonstrate real power behind the implications in cardiovascular syndromes. So I probably wind up going 10, 50, 40, which is kind of somewhere in the middle between all of you, actually. But I think that's how it turns out. Let me just ask real quickly before we go on to the next question, without any explanation, what would your individual assessment be of the odds of those three scenarios? And Peter, I'll start with you again, just the numbers this time.
My individual assessment would be 30, 60, 10.
Okay. Louise?
I think if I had to say my personal view and looking more in the future than I looked at from a current perspective and the need, I would probably go 30, 60, 10 again.
Okay. Stephen?
Well, given that I'm from Texas, and I think that my views are exactly the views that should be applied by everybody, I'm keeping them what I had before, which was 20, 70, 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And as I say, the problem with my view is that it's not purely scientific. It's predictive on how desperate we are to stop the pandemic. But if you simply asked me to choose numbers because I thought they were right, I'd probably wind up at about somewhere around where you guys are. Maybe I would go a third up front, so it winds up being 33, 57, 10, but that's just because it's 1 and 3, 1 and 10, and then whatever's left. So 33, 57, 10. It's interesting we wind up in the same place ourselves and somewhat different places when we think about our stakeholders. I think that's fascinating. Maybe a subject even for another day, but not this one.
I think that where, you know, I have a general scientific feeling, clinical and scientific feeling, that the ability of the liver as a central metabolic organ to respond to insults, including overwhelming viral infections such as COVID-19, is very important. So that's number one, and I agree with Louise on that. The second thing is that the fact that the liver is so important in so many diseases, that liver disease, and particular NAFLD and NASH, are intertwined with all other comorbidities. Maybe with the exclusion of pulmonary fibrosis, but even there might be some interaction. But cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, et cetera. So teasing out the effect of the liver versus other comorbidities is a challenge. Now, I'm 100% behind the idea that this association that has already been shown between NAFLD-NASH and the COVID-19 infection can be instrumental in dramatically increasing the visibility of fatty liver disease. And the reason, and a reason for individual liver health and promoting liver health. The issue, I think, for drug development is, are we going to have enough data and enough understanding of how to evaluate that in clinical trials to support a drug to be used in 100 million people in the United States for NAFLD. And that's where I think some of the likelihood starts to unravel a bit. But that's not maybe as important as having the general public recognize that healthy lifestyle and weight loss and exercise is important for your liver health, and the healthier your liver is, the less likely you're going to be to have severe COVID-19 disease. So I just kind of wanted, from my perspective, to kind of link all those things together a little bit.
Okay, thanks, Peter. I think I agree with you that probably the largest single challenge on all this is going to be there will be no way to do a prospective study on pandemic intensity virus and, say, response to any kind of drug, really, liver drug certainly, because the ethical consequences of getting somebody to take placebo won't work, and by the time will not be allowable. And by the time we get to standard of care, the numbers will be a decent standard of care. The need will be a little greater. We'll see how all that plays out. So let me staying with this idea that we're looking at three scenarios. Let me ask each of the group, I'll reverse order this time, start with Stephen. What do you see as two or three things that will happen over the next 5 years? Anything from clinical trials, M&A activities, retrospective studies, stock market issues, political events in any part of the world, that will serve as the key forks in the road in terms of whether we wind up going, whether the medical treatment and the market goes narrow NASH, broader NASH, broad fatty liver.
This one is a little bit tougher for me, I think, to pontificate on, just because of the unknown. I mean, it seems like we've been doing drug development in NASH for a while now, but we're still so early in our understanding of the pathogenesis, even the natural history of this disease, and certainly therapeutic efficacy. I mean, you think about the first drug coming to market and you know, by intent to treat, you're looking at about a 14% delta in fibrosis improvement of drug over placebo. And that drug is very likely to be approved. So, you know, the bar is pretty low on where we're going. But I think there will be some seminal forks in the road, if you will, that kind of allow us to converge on a way that we can identify and treat these people. And I think, you know, one of those is focused on the liver itself. One way to look at it is let's look at the liver itself and begin to see what we're doing to improve that. Another one would begin to look at outcome measures. And outcome measures I'm speaking of here are outside of the liver sphere, and particularly that's CV outcomes. So cardiovascular disease outcomes. And then ultimately, I think once we get beyond, and a third category that's marching in parallel with this is the development of our disease state awareness and a non-invasive testing strategy that allows us to do three different things. So very uncharacteristic of me, I have three different categories and then some subcategories under there. So just bear with me as I work through this. So in the liver world, first of all, I think once we have a drug that really impacts fibrosis and NASH resolution, I think that'll become the benchmark drug. That'll become the 800-pound gorilla the backbone therapy for this disease. Now, ideally, we want that to be oral. We want it to be well tolerated. We want it to be once a day, like taking a vitamin, something that doesn't have any side effects. People just take it, and it does miraculous things to both inflammation, hepatocellular injury, fat, and fibrosis. We're not there yet. We have some drugs in earlier development that look like they may be impactful in this arena. But I think once you get an FDA-approved treatment that hits both endpoints at the same time, that'll be a watershed moment in this disease and for the entire field. Moving away from that and now focusing on extrahepatic manifestations or improvements in this disease, I think, is cardiovascular outcomes. Once we have something that gives us a signal that we're changing the paradigm of how these people die most commonly over time, will be impactful. Now, we've never mentioned the third leading cause of death or the second leading cause of death in fatty liver patients, which is non-hepatic malignancy. And there's significant links in the literature to breast cancer, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, and I'm missing several cancers, but ultimately these are all inextricably linked to insulin resistance and obesity. And I think that ultimately we'll see improvements there. But the third area that is critical is this non-invasive testing, because we're never going to get where we want to be if we have to do liver biopsies. There's just not enough people to do liver biopsies. The complication rate is not where we would like it to be, even though it's low. But maybe the biggest thing is it's scary. It's scary to have a harpoon shoved into your liver. And that's why we try not to show the patients the needle when we do their liver biopsies, because it's scary. But let's focus on non-invasive testing. There are three different contexts of use where we really need to develop something. One is the diagnosis of NASH versus fatty liver. I need to know, as we talked about at the top of the broadcast, I need to know who is going to develop the more severe form of fatty liver and progress to cirrhosis and develop a decompensating event. That's one. Number two is markers of therapeutic efficacy. I need a non-invasive test to tell me if I put them on drug Y, that it's working, and how long I should treat them before I stop the drug, if at all. Number three, I need a marker that tells me long-term patient outcome benefit. And I think once we have a tool or multiple tools that can answer those three contexts of use, will be where we'll be moving into that next fork in the road. So collectively, just to review, a drug that moves fat and fibrosis, so steatohepatitis and fibrosis, will become a backbone drug. I think a drug that modulates CV outcomes, and I think non-invasive tests that address the three different contexts of use, wherever those come down the road, in whatever order they come in, each of those will be a fork in the road that gets us further to our overall goal of success in eradicating this disease.
Thank you, Stephen. That's a great answer. Going in reverse order, Louise, why don't you go next?
Thank you, Stephen. I thought that was a great summary, and it is a complicated area. I think I'd like to see this more as an opportunity. And I think the opportunity is there to make this more of a broad fatty liver opportunity by a disease awareness that allows people who are currently undiagnosed and unscreened to be located. Now, I think that means that we can be aggressive across the timelines. We can look at medications that can help people maximize their own input into their lifestyle alterations and monitor with non-invasive devices like FibroScan and some of the blood parameters. And I think it's an opportunity to be able to help with healthcare costs, because if we can utilize this to help reduce people's risk of NAFLD, we can help reduce the risk of the cost to cardiovascular symptomology and mortality, the cost acquired for type 2 diabetes, vascular surgeries when limbs are lost. And it's an early opportunity now to change the trajectory of metabolic disorders in patients that can make a vast difference to their own health, but only if they know that they have these risks. Currently, the majority of people, as we know, are undiagnosed. And when we all talk about patients in our practices and who we see, it is only the 1% that have gone to a physician who've made it through the pathway of healthcare to get to healthcare and specialists, who then get the opportunity to participate in these clinical trials. And I think I'd also like to see this as an opportunity by awareness of metabolic syndromes and diseases that all are correlated, to improve the amount of people who want to participate in clinical studies to find mechanisms to improve liver health beyond their own ability with lifestyle modifications, weight loss, bit of exercise, and particularly in children and teenagers. Because I think we're going to see cardiovascular mortality age groups drop as childhood obesity and fatty liver in children increases. So I think there's multiple forks in the road. For me, I think they're all about the opportunities that we can gain out of the period that we're in now. So yes, I ultimately like to see the patients and people take the power back with the medications and with the healthcare professions to try and reduce the comorbidities, the liver cancers that's associated with diabetes. And we know in a lot of these guidelines, patients with type 2 diabetes, it is recommended that they are screened for liver cancer and liver fibrosis because of their increased risk. But we don't see it happen too often. Hypertension, it's recommended that patients undergo assessments for fatty liver disease. But again, I know lots of people I see and have seen for years who have been told by their GP in primary practice years ago that on an ultrasound that they had fatty liver, but it wasn't seen as important. And I think we're driving now opportunities for clinical trials whereby this is probably one of the most important conditions. But we just don't see and hear liver mentioned enough by any healthcare providers. It's the poor relation. And I think we need to say the word more often. And we need to understand that everything we eat and drink goes through the liver. Every medication that we're using for to treat coronavirus and everything for these patients gets metabolized in the liver. So there is a potential knock-on effect. So the more patients that we can get and locate, the more opportunities we have to do all three of these scenarios, because we're going to find them at different stages on the pathway. So all three of your narrow, broader and broad fatty liver are really important as to where we're going to locate this population. And 23% of the global population are estimated to have NAFL. So it's a big ask.
Thanks for an excellent answer and a really different perspective. Peter, what do you think are the two or three major inflection points?
Well, I'm kind of struck with the fact that listening to both Louise and Stephen's answers, that I'm not often violently in agreement with everything they said. You know, they come from different perspectives, but I think that everything they said was quite right. I would think about the milestones that are going to change things as one, an inexpensive, readily available point of care test for significant fatty liver disease. I think that's really a very critical thing. And once we start identifying more people and can get broadly out there, I think that'll move things forward. I think that a drug that has sufficient efficacy in both fibrosis and NASH and fat, both fibrosis and fat, as Stephen said, is also very important. And we are very far away from that. Remember that, you know, something like a statin decreases cholesterol in everybody. You may not get optimal control with just a statin, but it decreases cholesterol in everybody. What we're seeing right now is, as Stephen said, in fibrosis, the drug that is being reviewed for approval has a 14%, you know, marginal efficacy over placebo. Well, that drug is never going to get close to broad use and preventative use. So a huge milestone and inflection point will be when there is a sufficient percentage activity in both fat and fibrosis to start thinking about those more preventative or earlier therapies. And I think that the we are headed towards things like cardiovascular and cancer outcomes, and the same goes for COVID-19. I think that we will have increasing data to show that COVID-19 outcome is related to liver disease, and the more data that we generate there is going to push forward the specter of liver disease in the community. So I think there are a number of different inflection points that are going to affect this this disease and market.
Okay, that's great, Peter, and a really nice summation and third point. Forecasters are accustomed to answering questions like this, and so I'm going to answer it and take a couple of risks at the same time. The first inflection point is going to come this fall. It's going to have nothing to do with medicine. It will have to do with, as I mentioned, the severity of a second wave of COVID-19. It will also have to do with the outcome of the U.S. election. The current administration has dealt with these kinds of issues at a funding level, at a population issue level, and a goals of society issue differently, really, than anybody who's ever come before in the history of the country, certainly since the Civil War. And if he is reelected, then we will stay, I think, on a path where the federal government will not particularly become a source of funding or coordination of research and intellect. And the U.S. has played that role for a long, long time, U.S. government. If, in fact, he were to be defeated, and I'm not going to comment on whether this is a good or a bad thing overall, but on this issue, I think we'd get better coordination and leadership with a different administration in Washington. And I think that's going to matter tremendously, particularly if there's a aggressive second wave of the pandemic this fall, number one. I think the second event is the one that Stephen is on, and then Peter also, which is we need an inexpensive way to figure out exactly what people's situation is. Not only a non-invasive test, but a non-invasive test that is reasonably inexpensive, either a low capital expense device or a test that can be done simply in blood and serum, that can be transported easily to many different locations and can be processed quickly and efficiently over time. And then the third is where Peter was, which is there has to be a good enough drug to do any of this. Now, if we're dealing with the second pandemic NAFL scenario, one might believe that any drug that does a decent job of reducing liver fat would be able to rise to that goal. And that might be a tad easier than the NASH objectives, where I think Peter's dead on. We've got to get a significant number of people who get improvement on both fat and on fibrosis, and we're not close to that right now. So I would say those are the three. Third question, okay. What is the one thing that you think your stakeholders are undervaluing when they look at this issue downstream, and what do you think they're overvaluing? Let's try to keep answers to a minute each so we can get Stephen out of here in another 6 minutes. Stephen, why don't you go first? Actually, Louise, you haven't gone first yet on anything. Why don't you go first?
I think if I have to say what some people take or undervalue is the fact that they've suffered from NAFL for so many years that they lose the confidence that they can make a significant difference to their own disease with very small changes. And when you talk about diagnostics, yes, I use FibroScan, but I use FibroScan and brief interventional therapy. And I think patients really engage with it. And I think very few patients engage with a biochemical formula that we use in clinics. But they do engage with seeing it and watching the technology. And I think they value that change that they can see, visualize, and regularly. So I think they undervalue their own ability to make a significant difference to liver health with minor changes. And I think what we may overvalue is looking for somebody else to provide us with the solution, the one pill that fits all, as Stephen described earlier. It would be lovely to think about that, but it may not happen right in the near future, and we can make a difference, and patients and individuals can make a difference to their own liver health, cardiometabolic health, and everything with really small changes to lifestyle, and it's achievable if supported in the right way. And I think that's key. They've got to be supported throughout this.
Okay, Stephen.
Okay, well, I actually agree with Louise on the undervalue. I think we say eat less, run more, very tongue-in-cheek when we talk about lifestyle modification. And I don't think that we really reinforce enough to a patient the benefits of what they can achieve with 10% weight loss, 7% weight loss, 5% weight loss, heck, any weight loss. You know, there's an old paper published looking from the NHANES database, looking at people with fatty liver. 50% of them are couch potatoes. Like literally they don't get off the couch. Like their idea of exercise is reaching for the clicker and going to the refrigerator. And their eyes moving when they read a book or something. I mean, literally the idea of even getting out and walking around the block is daunting to them. So I think just having a conversation about hashtag real talk. What are you doing every day? And it's something I tell my kids every day. It's not the one time that my son runs 5 miles and comes back in and says, "Dad, look what I did." It's, can you do that every day? Can you be consistent with it? It's one thing I learned in the military. When I wake up at 4 o'clock every morning and go do push-ups, sit-ups, and run and get yelled at by the drill sergeant, you know, after about a month of that, it becomes just what I do. And 4 years after being retired, I still do it. And it's just part of my DNA now. And so it's not part of the DNA of these patients. And so I know I'm going over my minute, but I'm on my soapbox, and Louise gave me that opportunity by mentioning what she said. And I totally agree with it. So undervalue, we have to do a better job of communicating with our patients and driving the real value into these patients to make the change they need to make. And as far as what I think we overvalue, I'm just going to agree with her again. I think we overvalue the importance of better living through chemistry. And while that is great, and we clearly need that, I don't think we spend enough time on the fundamental foundations of what we need to do to improve this liver disease. And I could keep going, but I'm going to stop there. I hope I bought Peter enough time.
you certainly provided me with an answer. I think that both Louise and Stephen have very nicely raised the specter of lifestyle and weight loss and so forth. One of the things that I think we undervalue as a medical community and people interested in public health is the fact that there is a very broad spectrum of behavioral and dietary things that you can do to lose weight. And I think when we talk to our patients, we tend to do a very narrow nutritional kind of focus that leaves out a lot of practical things, a lot of different dietary approaches that can help people. You know, for the longest time, as a medical profession, we told people, you know, a keto diet is just not good for you. Well, we now know that a keto diet is okay for you, and it can really kickstart people into weight loss. So I think we undervalue the broad range of things that can be used for lifestyle changes and dietary changes.
Okay. So let me take a slightly different perspective on some of this. I think what we undervalue is the impact that behavioral apps and programs that are more focused on wellness are likely to have in eliciting better behavior for people who want to behave better. You know, my wife actually works for one of those companies, and I'm impressed by how much success they are capable of having in getting people to relearn behaviors that lower weight. Now, you have to be motivated to ask, but people who start and are motivated tend to stay with it and have some tremendous success stories. Correlates to that, I think we overvalue the degree to which these are medical issues, that patients, there are all kinds of issues about how patients relate to their physicians, where they're less likely to not enough of them are likely to be as honest as we want them to be about the issues and practical challenges that they face because they see their doctor in a certain light. So while I believe the doctor has a tremendous role to play, I would love to see a world where there's greater interaction between physician or nurse. I think nurse advocates are a lot better at this than the doctors are, and apps and other kinds of techniques that people can use so that they can access the ways to improve their health on their own terms and in the ways that make them feel most comfortable. And I get very excited when I look and I see some of what's available there. So with that said, we're now at 3:47, 2 minutes over Stephen's stopping time. Why don't we go around, last round of questions. The one thing you heard today that surprised you the most or enlightened you the most, take it either way. Stephen, if you got to jump, let me let you go first.
You know, I think this is a great addition to the podcast to be on, because I think so often we are myopic as a physician and we don't necessarily see it through the lens of the patient. And so I think having that sense of clarity brought to the stage today was very helpful. I liked her comment that Louise changing the trajectory of a patient outcome by bringing awareness to the patient that small changes can equate to big changes down the road. And my analogy to that would be, again, an Army analogy in doing land navigation. If you give me an 8-digit grid coordinate that's 20 miles away and you give me a compass and say, go get it in the middle of the night with no lights, if I'm 1 degree off, well, for the first 100 yards, I can still be on target. I can readjust. But if I'm 1 degree off and don't reset my azimuth after the first mile, I'll never be able to regroup and get back on track. So it's all about perspective and it's all about small steps and readjusting and reevaluating and being persistent and being consistent with our messaging to our patients. And I think that was something that I'm going to reiterate in my clinic tomorrow. So thanks, Louise, for that input.
Pleasure.
That's great. Peter, next.
Yeah, I think the most surprising thing to me is that, other than Louise around the table, we're all kind of focused on drug development. And yet the conversation in this regard really was most rich when we started talking about societal issues and lifestyle issues and diet and patient perspective. And I think that really highlights where the fundamental solutions to fatty liver disease are going to lie in the near future before we have really safe drugs that work in a very high percentage of people. And even then, they're going to have to be really safe and really cheap. And sometimes cheap doesn't get into the equation. So I think that where we kind of shifted in terms of our discussion around the patient perspective, around public health and lifestyle issues, I think is very, very telling.
Peter, thank you for that. Louise?
I think I echo what both Peter and Stephen have said, and I think there's room in the treatment of NASH and NAFLD for everybody, and I think it is going to take everybody to pull together to help reduce the mortality that we're seeing and the rising mortality that we're going to see in all of these. And I think from my perspective, there are quick wins for patients. Walk down the stairs and catch the lift. That's way easier. But it's a quick win. It's a quick calorie burn. You don't need to get your heart rate up to 135, but you might just need to start walking. And I think, let's start with small steps. And I think it is making it achievable. And we can use the medications as we need them. But I think I just echo what Peter, yourself, and Stephen have said all the way through the podcast.
So thank you. And Louise, thanks for joining us today, making a really great contribution. In fact, for your first podcast, fantastic. What struck me is that, going back to what Peter said, when you think in terms of drug development, you think in terms of years, multiple years. So something that might look like it's in the near future might be 3, 5, 7 years away. Even without the issues of the pandemic, I don't think we have 3, 5, 7 years to wait on this. And the powerful idea of the patient perspective, as Louise points out, is you can get someone to start walking down the steps tomorrow. Literally. That's the place where we can make a difference now. And making a difference now is vitally important. And I think that's the one thing we've all taken away from this. So I want to thank our panelists for today. I want to thank Louise for stepping in. Louise actually will be back with us next week, because our topic is going to be taking a look at differences in patient treatment in the U.S. versus the U.K., patient advocacy really and support as well as treatment in the U.S. versus the U.K. And I want to thank our panelists for a really instructive session today. And we'll all be back with you next week on Surfing the Nash Tsunami. Thanks and have a good day.